from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Over his nearly 30-year career with the FBI, Special Agent Jeff Reinick worked cases of missing, exploited, and murdered children. And he came to be known for his skills in obtaining confessions from violent offenders, including Carrie Stainer, who killed four women and girls near Yosemite in 1999. But Reinick says that even in retirement, he can't let go of those children he couldn't find and couldn't help. And he'll join us to talk about his new memoir, In the Name of the Children, which looks back on his career bringing kidnappers and killers to justice, the psychological toll his work took on him, and what more can be done to prevent violence against children. That's all coming up after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Former Special Agent Jeff Reinick spent nearly 30 years in the Sacramento office of the FBI investigating cases of missing and murdered children. He's known for extracting a confession from Carrie Stainer, who killed four women and girls near Yosemite National Park back in 1999, and for his work on the 1991 abduction of J.C. Dugard in South Lake Tahoe. He's collected his experiences in a new memoir co-written with Marilee Strong called In the Name of the Children, and he joins us this hour to talk about the book and about his work and how it's affected his own psyche and what more needs to be done to prevent crimes against young people. And I want to put out a little serious caveat. We're going to be talking about some material here and content that is strong and that is in many ways difficult because the cases are difficult. And so lest you think you're going to be listening to an hour that's not taking on this very difficult topic, which we want to take on, of children who are abducted and murdered, you should know ahead of time. And welcome, Jeff Reinick.
Thank you.
Good to have you with us. This is, in some ways, it's kind of a true crime book. It's also a book about your personal experiences and about many of these cases and a variety of cases, all terribly disturbing, which is why I wanted to put out that warning. Missing children, murdered children, mostly here in Northern California. But let's talk first about the effect on you. You did this for many years. You did it for decades. And some of these certainly well-known cases caused a lot of problems for you. I mean, PTSD. If you didn't have a strong family, you might not even be here with us. PTSD, nightmares. Tell us about why the work was important to you.
Michael, I evolved into this work at my older son, when he was 3.5 years old, was afflicted with a kidney disease called nephrotic syndrome. It was 1 week after our second son was born, and it affected my wife and I, Lori. And even at this time, I was under transfer to the Sacramento office from the New York office of the FBI. And it was an unbelievable experience when you take your son to a medical facility or to a hospital and you have a cadre of doctors and nurses and social workers with you attending to you. I did not handle it as well as my wife did. And during this time, we transferred here to Sacramento. When we got here, without realizing it, I reacted to my son's illness by avoiding my family. I stayed at the office. When I got home, I went out to the garage. And one day, a chaplain came to see me and made me aware of this, which was huge. Around this time, we experienced in Sacramento a armed home invasion, which ended up being an abduction of a 7-month-old baby.
Listeners may remember, this is a Frankie Proctor case.
Frankie Proctor, yeah. Yes. And my squad at the FBI office worked this along with the Sacramento Police Department. I worked with Detective Greg Stewart. This was my first experience with a kidnapping case like this. Greg was a wonderful teacher, and I learned a lot from him. And together, working this, at the end of the week that the boy was abducted, we recovered him. And it was almost like an out-of-body experience for me. I had done something in the FBI I had never anticipated doing. And like any good bureaucracy, they realized that I was dedicated to this and started assigning me all these other cases.
And a number of these cases were abductions of a very different order than this one. This was in some ways kind of unique in many respects. Some of the people who did the abduction went with a shotgun and took the 7-month-old boy were, they felt they were doing a good deed in some respects. But then you got into all these cases where, I mean, and some, again, the memories of listeners can be long on these. For example, a case of a woman who was essentially poisoned her child by thinking she was giving her bleach, thinking that she was getting rid of demons. I mean, yes. You know, there's a whole bunch of very, as I said, different cases, variety of cases. But a lot of your work began to center on sexual abduction.
That's correct. What evolved was that most of these abducted children are abducted for sexual purposes. And with that realization came the realization or the evolution of learning to understand the motive and the way that sexual assailants, offenders, if you will pursue the children.
And that bears down on the Stainer case in some ways. I mean, because Kerry Stainer, who actually made his confession to you, who murdered these four people in Yosemite, a couple of children and a couple of women, people may remember, particularly brutal murders. I want to talk about how you got him to confess and all of that. But the reality was that his family suffered from a child abduction. His brother Stephen, people may remember, was abducted.
That's correct. In 1973, Stephen Stainer was abducted by an offender named Kenneth Parnell, and Stephen was held for 7 years. At the end of the 7 years, Stephen is now 14, and they went out and they abducted another 7-year-old boy. This is an example of how these offenders will have specific desires in their sexual fantasies. And when they went out and took the new 7-year-old boy, Stephen is now 14. He's not getting the attention he got. And he took the new boy and walked out. And when he walked into the sheriff's station, I think it was up in Ukiah, and they asked him what his name was, his response was that I think my first name is Stephen. He had forgotten his last name. And
he didn't want to see the same thing happen to this. I remember the boy's name was Timmy White, this child that Parnell had grabbed that happened to him.
Exactly. And I also believe that Stephen realized that what was happening to Timothy was not Timothy's fault. And the other effect it has on these victims, it makes them feel that they have no value. And they go through their life feeling that this is a reflection of who they are.
I want to talk specifically about the Kerry Stainer case with you, but you have a lot of insight in this book about the minds of some of these perpetrators. And you use a quote from Nietzsche about monsters, and one does think about these people as monsters because they prey on children and people think about it as evil, and it's hard not to make those associations. But you make a kind of, well, a case for compassion and for identifying, even if that's sometimes possible, even with some of these people, which is very hard for many human beings to do who don't think like they think and don't feel the kind of drives and out-of-control needs that they have.
I have been judged because I don't have this automatic reaction of kill them, or people say, how could you sit across from them and not want to kill them or beat them up? The reality, in my experience, is that the overwhelming majority of these offenders are themselves victims. And from the extensive experience I've had, I developed a personal theory that you could tell the age that the offender was victimized by looking at the age of his preferred victim. And I had a case, which is also in the book, about Danny. And in that case, the boy who killed him was mentally disabled, had a very low IQ, not capable of understanding the concept of death or right or wrong. And here's an example of a boy who was assaulted at age 6. And from that point on, all he wanted to do was sexually assault other boys that were age 6.
But in many respects, the Kerry Stainer case was anomalous because he was molested. In fact, his family had a history of sexual problems in terms of molestations and so forth. I'm not only talking about his brother, Stephen, but within the history of the family, the genealogy of the family. What really kind of struck me was, yes, maybe the majority of these may have been the result of young people who were offended early on. He was sexually offended by his uncle, but before that even, he had fantasies, you write in the book, that were really quite violent. whether he was like 6 or 7 years old, before his brother was taken or before he was molested.
And in order to understand those early fantasies, it's my opinion that you have to go and look at the family dynamic. And in my experience with Carrie's father and mother, they were parents just like we all are parents. And when they realized what happened to both of their sons, we as parents looked to ourselves for why did this happen? But Carrie's mother, Kay, was emotionally withdrawn. She grew up being taught to be emotionally withdrawn. And I think the lack of emotional interaction in the family was a factor in Carrie's thinking. And when he was assaulted at age 11 by his uncle, I think that's when his sexual fantasy started taking shape. And ironically, because of my knowledge of the case, he preferred young girls in that age area of 11, 12 years old. But he was also opportunistic, so if he could get girls of that were slightly older, he would pursue that.
It was kind of shocking also to read that even when you brought him in and he was confessing, he wanted to give you more detail based on providing him with pictures, photographs of children who had been abused and children who were naked and that sort of thing.
And although we don't like to think that we can be shocked or caught off guard, I'm here to tell you that unlike what a lot of guys portray themselves to be, when these things happen, you're worried you're going to do the right thing. And when he asked me to show him child pornography, which he wouldn't call child pornography, but when he asked me for that in exchange for confessing to homicides, that was a little beyond the old, that was over the top. But luckily, and what I want people to realize is there's a whole group of us. There was my friend Ken Hitmeyer and John Bowles. We all have each other to talk to get support from, and to help us make these decisions. And Ken eventually was the one who said, no, this isn't going to happen. And he was right. But at the time, when you're on the precipice of a confession, you're thinking like a salesman, what can I do? What can I offer him? What can I do to get him to go all the way?
We're talking, by the way, with Jeff Reinick, and he is a retired FBI special agent specializing in child exploitation cases and owner of Reinick & Associates, which is a private investigative and consulting business, co-author with Merrily Strong of In the Name of the Children, an FBI agent's relentless pursuit of the nation's worst predators. Merrily used to work in an office near here for Focus Magazine, which was a KQED magazine, and I think you probably realize you're fortunate to be working with her.
I love Merrily. Merrily,
first-rate journalist.
Yeah. Merrily and my wife, Lori, are my women.
Well, getting back to the Stainer case, though, and in general, these kinds of cases, I mean, you came to the conclusion, I think, in your book that, okay, they're not monsters. We have to see their humanity, their personal history and everything, but keep them away from children. And because in so many cases, they can't keep themselves away from children. And the whole idea of some kind of therapy or rehabilitation for these people, futile in many respects, is it not?
My personal opinion is that there's no known therapy for people who prefer children as their sexual partners. I also believe there's no therapy for people who are sexual sadists or who are sexually aroused through watching the suffering of another person. The most compelling people I've spoken to who are these offenders have said to me and follow a very strict rule of life that they don't allow themselves to be near children. And it's not that they feel that they don't have the internal strength. They just know that they should not put themselves in that situation. And I respect that.
This is a bizarre disconnect, though. I mean, even in the case of Stainer, he would not hunt or fish because of his love of animals, I presume. I mean, this is true about somebody like Charles Manson, who watched where he was walking so he wouldn't step on ants, or Hitler, who loved apparently animals and yet can, you know, beheaded a woman. I mean, you know, things like this just don't equate in people's minds.
And where people come to judge me is that, in my opinion, Carrie Stainer, when he committed his crimes, held each of the four victims as they died. And I've read and been trained that holding someone, and I know from my own experience with my parents, that when you're with someone and you're physically holding them at the time of death, it's a very, very intimate moment. And I think that's what he sought. And when
he sought intimacy, you believe?
That's what I believe. Yeah. That's my opinion. And in Joey Armstrong's case, when he did what he did to her, I do believe that he was basking in a moment of intimacy, feeling that he had moments with her that were unlike any moments he would have with anyone else.
You were also, because of that sense that you had of this being a need for intimacy, reluctant to call him or many of these other predators psychopaths or sociopaths.
I believe very strongly in a book entitled Without Conscience, written by Dr. Robert Hare. And in his book, he sets forth the possibility that psychopaths are people that are born without the capability to feel emotion. I read that book the first time when dealing with a very brutal crime scene, which again is in the book about Michael. And also with Michael, I went back and read that book again to try and understand how someone can do what they did to him and still live with themselves. And that book gave me, I won't say comfort, but I'll say the understanding, the ability, if you will, to go on and to understand that there's some things in some people that I will never be able to understand.
Well, the Stainer case wasn't even supposed to be your case. I mean, you picked him up as a material witness in a nudist camp, which is kind of a strange thing to think if they ever make a movie of this, how that would play. I mean, it's kind of farcical elements, putting handcuffs on a guy and all that. But you wanted, it seemed to me, at least the way you write about it, not to go through what you've been trained to do, which was, let's talk about this Reed interrogation method. That was what all FBI agents were doing at the time, or most of them, yeah?
When I meet these people, I don't look at them as an object from whom I have to get a confession. I want to know who they are. I want to know what they did. But more importantly, I want to know why they did what they did. I have an undying fascination, need to know. Maybe that's my sense of closure, is to know why, or at least to come up with some ability to come close to knowing why. And when I meet these people, I don't judge them. I look at them as having a reason. Now, in Michael Lyon's case, Robert Rhodes, who killed him, I believe he's a psychopath, and he's a person I could never talk to or interview. But when you take other people, I had an interview with a young man one time who was 19 years old, and he killed a 15-year-old boy. And during the interview, when I was talking to him, I didn't start out, you know, what did you do? Why did you do it? You did this, you did that, give him minimization abilities. I asked him, if you could have anything in the world, anything, what would you want? And he answered me that he would want to be loved and he would want someone to love. Now, how do you judge a person that says that?
Well, you mentioned the word closure, and I'm going to open your book here. And you talked about, you used that word with Kerry Stainer, and you also had him write, once he did confess, a letter of apology. And this is a technique that I was struck by in many ways. You say you always know it. Well, I talked about the concept of closure, which to me doesn't mean that all the pain is done and gone, but that was what was once an open wound becomes more like a scar. You always know it's there, but you're able to get on with your life. I told him that because of the cases I worked, I had contact with people who might be able to help him feel better and come to terms with what had happened to his brother. I asked him if he had gotten counseling, and he said he had tried but felt it did not help. In other words, you're trying to meet him on a human-to-human level.
Absolutely. And when I met Kerry Stainer, I was told that he was a witness that was running in fear, that he may have known the victim and that he was fleeing because he was afraid for his own safety. Myself and the agents that were with me and the Sacramento County Sheriff's deputies that were with us, we had no idea that he was being looked for as a murderer.
Well, this brings in the fact that you had superiors who had a totally different theory about some people involved, and some listeners may remember the whole case. There's a lot of suspicion of a couple of methamphetamine, call them users, pushers, but there was a lot of violence, and they had serious jackets, records, and so forth. So a lot of suspicion was on them, and you were getting a lot of interference from higher up. In fact, you write about this with some, well, asperity, I think, and real sense of they were wrong, and they were trying to lead me in a different direction, trying to lead the public in a different direction.
Again, there are some people that judge me over this, but all I know is to be honest and to be myself. And in this case, when I met Kerry Stainer, I knew who his brother was, and the most important thing he meant to me was to try and understand what we as law enforcement could have done better to help his family do better. And that's what I wanted to know from him. And in the course of discussing that is where the idea of He appeared not to have come to terms with it, and the idea of maybe I could use my contacts to get him help. And I mean all that. I would have done that had he had this persisted. I would have. I keep my word to everyone I meet.
So let's take the real question here. What can be done to prevent violence against children? I mean, I know you have this business now that's essentially is trying to do something about that. We can talk about it specifically. But, I mean, what do you tell ordinary citizens, especially in light of the fact that there was understandably real anger in Kerry Stainer because of what happened to his brother's abductor, Kenneth Parnell? He got, what, 5 to 7 year sentence or something?
He got 7 years when he kept his brother for 7 years.
He kept the brother for 7 years and he got 7 years. This is unfair by any standard.
Absolutely.
And to release him again and put him out there, what can we do?
What can we do? When I retired from the FBI, I partnered up with a friend of mine named Chris Hopkins and, of course, my wife, Lori, and we tried to do a startup company. And we came up with a philosophy that we turned into a software prototype that focused on identifying children at risk on the internet. And we believed that the answer to that was parental interaction, parental oversight, not spying, not anything like that. And the reason
Not monitoring.
And that's why I bring this up now, because I think in any family, with any child, the answer is to have the parents interacting with their children, constantly assuring them of their love and their value. Every child victim I meet has two basic beliefs that are impossible to unseat. Number one, they feel that what happened to them was their fault. And number two, they feel it's a reflection of themselves. Little girls grow up and will harm themselves and become prostitutes and end up with violent men because they feel they have no value. Unfortunately, little boys will grow up and they will harm outside themselves.
So you're really prescribing the importance of love and value and valuing the children and being good parents and all the rest of that. But what about the justice system in all this? I mean, in many ways, you talk about some of your superiors, as I said, in the FBI, is really taking leads and going with them when they shouldn't have, and some serious miscarriages of justice, like the Stephen Stainer case and so forth. Thoughts about that?
Well, when I think about the justice system, I could be here the rest of the day talking to you about that. Concerning the controversy regarding my superiors at the FBI, I can say that myself and the people I work with, we were on the street. We started on the street. We ended on the street. We lived the street. It's like in that movie, Mississippi Burning, when Gene Hackman says to Willem Dafoe, these people came out of the gutter and you have to get back in the gutter to see what they do. And that's who we are. The superiors, the people that work their way up in management in the FBI, they're not in the gutter. They're not working this stuff. So their reasons for wanting to do what they do are theirs. Our reasons are because we want to help.
As long as you mention a movie, we should also say that one of the ways you actually kind of made connection with Stainer was saying that he reminded you of Billy Jack, the character in that movie, as many people may remember. We'll talk more with Jeff Reinick, talking about his career fighting crimes against children. And you can certainly join this conversation. I invite you to do that now. Our toll-free number is available. The number to call, 866-733-6786. Join us at that number, 866-733-6786, or join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking this hour with Jeff Reinick. He's a retired FBI special agent specializing in child exploitation cases and owner of Reinick & Associates, which is a private investigative and consulting business, and co-author with Merrilee Strong of a book called In the Name of the Children, an FBI agent's relentless pursuit of the nation's worst predators. And I read the book, and you are pretty relentless. Let's talk about how things unfurled, though, with Kerry Stainer. When did you first get suspicious of him? Because as you've outlined it, your superiors thought he was just a witness, maybe, or nothing more than that.
At the risk of appearing to be less than a leading man, I was never suspicious of him. When I met Kerry Stainer and we were talking to him and he mentioned about his uncle, I didn't even see anything in that until he mentioned that he had been molested. Then I suspected maybe his uncle. But until he decided to tell me what he had done, I had no suspicions of him because we were told he was a witness.
we're going to go to our callers here. I'm really interested in hearing what people have to say and ask of you, but I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about, in light of what you said about criticism of the superiors, and actually you name names here, what about the FBI today? I mean, what's your response? You've been retired from the agency for a number of years, and a lot of them, like you, are out there on the street, the kind of people you alluded to, doing good work and doing, you know, yeoman work, men and women, obviously. And you give a lot of props, as I think is worthy, of a lot of these people who go into search and rescue mode, you know, and volunteer their time when a child is abducted. It was important to read that part of your analysis, too. But the morale must be terrible in the FBI now. I mean, I'm just saying that because you have an administration that's been very antithetical, very critical, and very strongly, in many ways, contemptuous.
When I retired, one of the benefits was I could still tell people I was an FBI agent, but I didn't have to go into the office on Monday. So it was the best of both worlds. For me, the FBI is the people I worked with, the people in the Sacramento division, in the New York office, in the Chicago division, that were on the street, that were catching fugitives, that were working late hours. The people that go to Washington and become the managers, I don't know them, and I don't know much about them.
So somebody like James Comey, for example, that's not your world.
No, that's not my world.
And it's not necessarily a world that you have approval or disapproval of, or more disapproval?
The most I'd like to say, Michael, if you'll let me off the hook after this, is that when in the FBI, we had several paths we can follow. One of them was the management program. And if you chose the management program, you were moving two or every 3 years, you moved up to 10 times in your career. And I believe that that puts a hardship and a destructive factor on your family. And I always felt that it was very hard for me to trust people who would put their job in front of their family.
You also have a lack of trust that comes through in the book for polygraphs, which I think is important to get on here for just a moment, because there is, particularly in these kind of cases, a great deal of credence often put in polygraphs.
If you consider the machine, the polygraph itself, it measures physiological activity of your body. But when you factor into that equation the polygraph examiner, that is where I have 100% faith. Our polygraph examiners are the main ones I've worked with in my career. The FBI polygraph examiners are beyond belief.
But like you said, someone can come in and be nervous, and it can be a negative test when they're telling the truth. And just you have a kind of pathological liar who can be speaking a falsehood or a lie, and it doesn't come across as any nervousness.
And that's the value of the polygraph examiner, because he's the person, or she is the person, that can see those items and can factor them into the results that they get.
Again, we're talking to Jeff Reinick, and his book with Marilee Strong is called In the Name of the Children, An FBI Agent's Relentless Pursuit of the Nation's Worst Predators. Aaron mentioned that Jeff and his co-author Marilee Strong are on the faculty of the Mystery Writers Conference, which is held at Book Passage in Corte Madera, September 27th to September 30th. And here's a question from a listener before we go to our caller. It says, has the widespread proliferation of pornography decreased sexual crime rates over the last few decades, particularly those against children?
I don't believe it has.
If anything, it might be the opposite. Huh?
I do believe that. And I believe people who look at child pornography are more likely to want to offend in physical reality.
And someone else says, are almost all crimes, I guess you answered this before, but against children still perpetrated by family, friends of family, and authority figures?
The great majority of crimes against children are perpetrated by people they know. And if you look at the process of offenders and how they groom their victims, their goal is to put themselves in a position of trust and confidence. So if you factor that into the classification, almost everybody that offends against a child knows that child.
Let's hear from our listeners, and let's begin with the caller. Rob, good morning. You're on the air.
Thank you. First of all, I'd like to thank this gentleman for the job that he did working for the FBI. That is just, thank goodness there's people like you out there trying to get these guys. But my question is, a while ago there was a child molester on another station, and they interviewed him for quite a while. It was really fascinating to kind of get into his head. And he talked about, in just kind of matter-of-fact terms, how he just saw young people that were, you know, little kids as sexual objects. It was just kind of like the way we think of we're attracted to people that are more age appropriate. This guy was attracted to kids, and it was like just a mindset, the way his brain was wired. And it didn't sound like there was any way you were going to therapy, whatever, was going to change that. How dangerous are these people once they're let out of jail, if they're caught for their crimes? Should they ever be allowed to get out?
Well, I think your observation is 100% correct. And what you heard that person saying, I think, was very well said. And in terms
of, someone said, put them on an island like Napoleon had in mind for criminals, Elba Island or something like that.
I don't know what the social answer is going to be, but it's my opinion that these people can never be in the presence of children without posing a risk to them.
In fact, you're right about it. I mean, because you kind of got in a lot of their heads. They're just driven. This is an obsession. Even when they're in prison for, say, 7, 8 years, 10 years, whatever it may be, it's often most of what they're thinking about.
I became certified as a criminal profiler. And during that training, one of the things that I learned that still fascinates me to this day is that if we fantasize about winning the lottery, we'll say, oh, we'll pay off our bills, we'll do this. But offenders, just as your caller just said, when they fantasize about it, they fantasize to the nth degree. They fantasize down to the grain of the wood that's in the room they're in or on the dashboard of the car. And when you think about that, that betrays the level of planning and thought. And it's all they think about.
Do you know anything about recidivism rates for these crimes? Is it higher than other crimes?
I do believe they're higher. I only say that because I used to attend a program that the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, their paroles division, put on, where sex offenders, as a condition of parole, would agree to be interviewed in a law enforcement meeting. And we saw many of these people over and over. And they themselves said they would come. They would always go out and looking to reoffend. We had one guy who said that he was going to leave the state and go to some state where he believed it was legal to marry an 8-year-old girl. So we conveniently helped him with that by arresting him before he left.
Here's a question from a listener named Dave who says, your guest states that he believes there is no curing of sexual attraction to violence on or children. And why are these not capital crimes? If there's no rehabilitation possible, why should the public keep these criminals alive?
The matter of what's a capital crime belongs to the legislature. And they use our voices, yours and mine, to determine what should be legislation to and place into society to handle these matters.
Another listener wants to know your view on chemical castration.
It's been my experience from dealing with these people that chemical castration, physical castration, does not work. It's in their mind.
I think the data is there that it doesn't work.
It doesn't work. Yeah. It doesn't work. They still offend.
Let me get another caller on, and we go to you, Elena. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I was just wondering what the percentage is of the male, or rather of the perpetrators, how many of them themselves have been victims, and is there a higher percentage male versus female as far as the perpetrators?
Yeah, actually, Jeff had said before that the majority have been abused or offended. It's overwhelmingly male, though, is it not?
I believe it's overwhelmingly male because I think little girls that are offended against will grow up and harm themselves and harm within themselves, whereas the males will harm outside of themselves.
Let me get to some more callers. Let me thank you for the call and go next to Jim in Fremont. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi there. Thanks for, you know, taking this very difficult topic on a Monday morning. Now, what I was wondering was that there are these reports in media which are kind of trying to say that attraction towards children is something that these folks are born with, and really we should be treating them with more, with gentler gloves than what we have been treating them with. So do you think there is a movement towards normalizing pedophilia? Like, do you see the change in the society over the years that you've been working on this particular subject?
Thank you for the call. Jeff Reiner?
I don't think there's anything that's positive in normalizing the thought of an adult having sexual relations with a child. And I am not sure, I personally don't believe these people are born with this. I believe that it occurs through their upbringing and their environment And as I've said, I think a great majority of these people have been victimized themselves. And there's something inside of them, at least in my opinion, that freezes or the maturity stops when you see many times 70-year-old guys with 20, 30-year-old girls, and you think, how can he relate to them? Well, there, in my opinion, there's an essence in their mind where they see themselves as that age. And I think that's one of the things that happens.
And let me thank the caller. We'll bring another caller aboard here. Let me go next to you. Melanie, thank you for waiting. You're on the air.
Yes, hi, thanks. I just wanted his view on the whole Catholic Church sex scandal. Can those priests be in any way? What can be done about that? Thank you very much.
All right, thank you for the call. We did spend an hour on that. It's in our archives on the particularly stuff that came out in Pennsylvania about priests molesting children and the bishops not really doing enough or doing much at all. But your thoughts, Jeff Reiner?
My thoughts are that the priests that are molesting children are sex offenders. They're offenders, and they should be treated the same way any other offender is treated. In terms of the church covering up or mitigating the exposure, that's something that's outside my ability to address.
You did some profiling. Talk about how do you profile a sexual abuser or a sexual sadist? Other than if you don't know about this family history.
What I like to do if I am dealing with a suspect, I like to interview the wife or the girlfriend or the people that are most significant in their lives. And then I'd like to do a very in-depth interview about their sexual activity. And in that regard, that's what tells me about their true actions. And when I know those things, then I'm ready to speak to the offender.
It's like there are clues, for example, a guy who likes to use bondage and choke and all those kinds of things might be a good suspect for somebody who's choking women to death, that sort of thing.
I once met a woman who was 47 years old. She was starved down to 80 pounds. And when I began the interview with her, I asked her about, she looked very similar to her daughter, actually. And when I began talking to her, I always asked the question, did your husband want you to be clean shaven in your pubic area? And she at first said, and many people will say, oh, he wanted me to be clean. I wanted to be clean and healthy. And she was in such poor physical condition that I told her I wished her the best, and I left, and I hoped that her life went well. I got about 10 steps out the room, and I remember hearing her screaming my name to come back. And when I went back, the first thing she told me was that he had purchased for her a $150 special electric shaver for her to be clean shaven. And the point of that is that an symptom of these guys is they will try and duplicate the appearance of their preferred victim with the partner they have.
Didn't Stainer do that with one of his victims?
Yes. With Julie, he had Julie shave herself, and he brought that up in the interview, and I knew exactly what that meant when he brought it up.
Important question from a listener. It says, what about red flags parents should look as far as their children's relationships to teachers or coaches? What about young kids who can't quite communicate yet?
One of the things I see frequently with children that have been offended against is that they will act out. Michael Lyons, for instance, in the book, when we interviewed his friends at school, the children described that Michael would act out on them quite a bit in a sexual way. And as it turned out, and I don't want to get into his private information, but it's in the book, but he had been assaulted when he was 3 years old.
Can you talk a little, we'll get to more callers, but talk a little bit more about this effect on you of these cases that you worked on, because it was profound.
It was, and I've always prided myself on putting my family ahead of anything. But what was happening to me and what I didn't understand was that the crime scenes, the sights, the experiences of hearing these things and talking about these things, they started affecting my ability to live, actually. And I reached a point where I actually identified more with the children than I did with life. And at this point, my family, who I credit with my life, they recognized this, and it was a very difficult time for them because they were harmed by hearing about these cases because I didn't keep things from them. But then they were harmed by seeing how I was dealing with these cases and the effect it would have on me. My wife, Lori, went through about 5 years with me where she wasn't sure what she was doing with me.
Sounds like an extraordinary woman. And she was the one who convinced you you had to write this book and work with Merrily on it, wasn't she?
Yes, she was. My wife wanted me. I actually wrote the manuscript for my children, and I wrote it as if I was writing to them. And when my wife, Lori, saw this, she said, you've got to share this. It could help people.
What did you have to do with the J.C. Dugard case? That was pretty early on, wasn't it?
J.C. Lee Dugard was abducted on June 10th, 1991 at 8:15 in the morning. I was asked to participate in that case a year later. I teamed up with a co-agent named Chris Campion, who was the South Lake Tahoe agent, and the two of us worked this case tirelessly until I retired in 2006. And I remember when, I think it was 2008 that she was found, I remember getting the call from Chris telling me that he was on his way to go see her. And it was very, very emotional. But what really affected me that both my sons called into me when they found out she was being recovered. And I had taken my family, every time we went to Tahoe for vacation or to do something, I always took them by the abduction site. I always showed them everything that happened. We went through the narration of how it occurred. And I said, you know, what are we missing? What are we missing? And when she was recovered, my sons had been carrying her information and her picture in their wallets. And this is an example of how it affected my family. I didn't even realize.
Well, you talk about your family a lot, but you also talk in the book about the families of victims, and it became very important for you to try to seek justice for those families. And so many of these cases remain unsolved. And I think at one point you say as many cases as there have been, there are probably twice as many as at least the numbers that we can crunch, because a lot of them go unreported. I also ought to say there apparently are some mixed opinions on the idea of the effectiveness of chemical castration. I remember reading something to the effect that it was, as what you said, that it's still in the mind of many of the perpetrators to want to do these kinds of things. But whether it's been proven to be effective may be an overstatement, and I don't want that necessarily to be interpreted as such. Let me get to some more of our callers, though. Let me get to Shabazz in Oakland. Shabazz, you're on.
Yeah, how you doing this morning?
Okay, thank you.
Hi, Shabazz.
I just want to say that, you know, I agree with you that it is a mindset thing. And I think that a huge influence on the way people think is the influence of media. Not the only thing, but it plays a primary part, because if you notice, everything that you see in media today is sexually based. I mean, almost everything is sexually based, you know, from sitcoms to dramas. I once saw event on Criminal Minds, and in order to write a show like that, you have to have a criminal mind. And if the youth,
that doesn't mean they create or act criminally.
It's from real imaginary deep thought. And, you know, even the SVU criminal, you know, sexually thing. And, you know, you see these victims on there. And I'll finish when I say this one thing, just to give you an example. This one young girl was gang raped. And it seemed like she said, I couldn't help it. My body was moving. My body was moving like she enjoyed it, you know. And it's like all these kinds of things affect the way people think. You know,
well, there's a lot of, Shabazz, your point's well taken, because there's many people have written about the sexualization of children in today's popular culture and in the media and so forth. How much do you think, Jeff Reinick, that plays a role in what we're talking about here? I mean, there have always been sexual crimes against children going back to antiquity. But.
Well, I think media plays a role. The whole 360-degree realm of the circle, they exacerbate the problem, but at the same time, they can make the problem better. If you look at the commercial advertising and in our society of wanting to be more acceptance, you see in the commercials, there's a greater degree of variability in the people that are together in the commercials and participate in the commercials. And I think that ability of the media to affect our thought at our level, on the street level, is very important and can be employed to help these issues.
What do you think about something like popular crime shows that Shabazz was talking about, Law & Order, Special Victims Unit? Does it help or hurt working to protect children?
I don't know. I must admit, Michael, I don't really watch them that much. And when I do watch them, they kind of make me upset. But one thing I can tell you that they do miss is the emotional trauma that they cause to the investigators, these crimes to us who work these, because I believe we become extended victims. And they totally miss out on the camaraderie and the collaboration that is caused amongst us to work together to achieve this mission. There's no one hero. There's no one star. It's all of us together that make it work.
And again, we're talking with Jeff Reinecke. He's a retired FBI special agent specializing in child exploitation cases, owner of Reinecke and Associates, and co-author with Merrily Strong of In the Name of the Children, an FBI agent's relentless pursuit of the nation's worst predators. And he will be appearing again at Book Passage between September 27th and 30th with Merrily Strong. And you're listening to Forum, and this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, simply go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And let me go to another caller, and that's you, Felicia. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, hi, Felicia.
Good morning.
You're on the air.
Yes, good morning. We had some people observe a woman at our local park taking photos of children at the park. When she was confronted, she ran off to a truck with a male driver. And I was curious as to if offenders use this type of strategy to choose or stalk a victim.
What do you think, Jeff?
Absolutely. We see many of these crimes are committed by a man using a woman. Unfortunately, when we think about little girls that grow up to harm themselves and feel a loss of self-value, these people prey upon that. So I've seen cases where women who have absolutely no sense of value or belonging will be controlled and latch on to a male offender who can guide them to do what he wants. J.C. Lee Dugard is a great example of that.
It's a perfect example, yeah.
Philip Garrido and his wife, Nancy, when you break them apart, that's when you start getting the true answers about what the guy's like. And what's always unbelievable to me is to hear the descriptions of the guy from the woman when she's not worried about how he feels about her.
Well, he's for the most part, they are worried about how, because often they can be using physical force and punishment against the women and abuse of one sort or another. But also you hear these stories about women who say to kids, you want to see a puppy or something like that, or a bunny or whatever.
Yes,
and then
yes.
The guy's waiting in the van.
And Michael, I'd like to add that in the book, in the chapter, the 22, we address that a little bit, because in that instance, we're talking about ritualized abuse of children by two separate families. And I do describe how the woman in that instance who participated became a part of that scenario.
And we'll bring another caller aboard here, and that's Lisa from Oakland. Good morning.
Hi. Well, first of all, I just wanted to thank you for the work you're doing as a feminist. I think this is very important. However,
thank you.
I want to say that I also feel like you're really dehumanizing these people who you've even said are victims. And even as a feminist, I think the world we want to create is not one where we are dehumanizing these people, but actually understanding that it's this society, this dehumanized society, that's creating these people, and that we don't solve this by locking people up. We create another society by having empathy, caring, and rehabilitation for people, and envisioning another way of relating to people.
But if there's no possibility,
excuse
me, Lisa, what if there's no possibility for rehabilitation?
I don't believe that. Well, I don't believe that. That they've said this. This has been said around many other types of offenders, people who murder, people, all kinds of things. So I think that, yes, obviously these people need help, but the help they need is not to be further brutalized. We don't need to create a – we are all brutalized. This person just talked about – this man just talked about how working in this field has damaged him. We are all been brutalized in the society. We create a different society by creating a more caring society.
Well, there are many professionals who agree with Lisa, who say rehabilitation can be effective. There's mixed evidence. Jeff Reinecke, what do you say to that?
Lisa, thanks for calling in, and thanks for what you're saying. And I hope nothing in my comments dehumanizes anything about this, because it is the humanness of it that is what I and it concerns. In terms of what you're discussing, I'm just a simple person who was on the street. I'm only describing what I encountered on the street. I'm not at a level to decide what can or cannot be done for these people or whether rehabilitation. I'm simply saying that in the case of a person who prefers a child victim and a person who prefers to receive sexual arousement from suffering, it's been my experience that because we see these people over and over and over, and what they say, that these people, I don't know of anything that can help them. I'm not a psychiatrist. I'm not a psychologist. I don't have the ability to determine what can help these people.
Let me thank you, Lisa, for the call. And Deirdre wants to know, is it possible most people who have sexual fantasies about children don't act them out?
Yes, I think most people that have, we all as humans have sexual fantasies. I don't mean to belie myself, but when I dated my wife, I wanted to have a wonderful date. I cleaned the car. I got a workout in. I picked out the clothes I wanted to wear. Everybody has sexual fantasies. It's the nature of who we are. The people that have sexual fantasies that they know to be unusual or criminal, they're the ones that have to not go over the line. And it's the ones that do go over the line that we're talking about.
And Jeff Reinick, again, is the author with Merrilee Strong of In the Name of the Children, an FBI agent's relentless pursuit of the nation's worst predators. Good to have you with us, Jeff. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. And we'll be back with you, if all goes according to plan, tomorrow at 9 with Mike Leibovich will be joining us. So we'll be talking about the NFL, about many other things as well with him. Jeff Leibovich, excuse me. Thank you for being with us this morning. I'm Michael Krasny.